Welcome to Goodniks, a podcast about doing good in the world. Together, we dig into the experiences of people who do good in very different ways to understand what inspires them, what frustrates them, and what keeps them going. I'm Annalisa Enrile, a social worker, professor, and human rights activist. Whether you're doing good yourself or just thinking about it, I'm glad you're here. In our last episode, we unpacked the internal struggles, the personal sacrifices, and the external pressures our Goodniks confront as they do good in the world. What did they have to give up to do this work? In this episode, we talk to our Goodniks about who keeps them going. We hear stories about the people who light their way and give them strength.
I mean, the beautiful thing about starting the school is I don't think I had any idea what I was really like in for. Like if someone had said to me, here's what's going to happen, I'd been like, I'm never applying for that. I know, like no way.
Chris is a teacher, principal, and founder of award-winning magnet schools in Philadelphia.
You know, I still tell the kids to this day that like when I was starting the school, I was also getting pursued to go be a Division II women's basketball coach because I love coaching. And not shockingly, the collegiate coaching job process was moving much faster than the school district was. And it got to the point where it's like, I was going to have to either start to really pursue that. I was going to have to really pursue one or the other. And I said, you know what? There's probably a whole lot of people who can coach basketball every bit as well as I can. But I don't think there's that many people out there who'd start the school I would start. And so I won't coach basketball anymore. I'll go do the thing. And 16 years later, three schools later, pretty sure it was the right call. Although on the hard days, I'm like, man, I could be in a velour tracksuit right now. This would be so much easier. My wife's career was at a crossroads and she was kind of at a place where like New York City wasn't necessarily where we wanted to be long-term. My career as a teacher, I was kind of at a place where I was like, okay, I've been at my school 9 years. There was some leadership change. There were some different things going on that I was like, okay, maybe you need to think about what's next. I wrote up a white paper of what I thought a school could be. I called it the Philadelphia Academy of Teaching and Learning, which would have had the wonderfully unfortunate acronym of PADL. Again, that whole like, I like to be funny joke never lands, but I'd still tell it. But I talked to some people who knew what we were up to in New York City. I got together an advisory board. I wrote up a white paper of what I thought a school could be. And I just started knocking on doors. And I'd never done anything like this before. Like, I'm not that person. I'd never been that, oh, I can go do a thing. I'm a little more risk averse than that, but I felt like this was the thing I was supposed to do. My whole thing was like never end a meeting without knowing what my next meeting was. And if four people were standing on a street corner talking about schools, I wanted to be there. And literally like would take days off from school and like take the train down to Philly, you know, like for a meeting. And then like at the end of them, I'd say like, who should I talk to next? At one of those meetings in the building that eventually became my school, they converted some district offices to a school building for a while. That was our first location. This woman who was like right out of central casting, she'd been retired, but was now consulting for the district. She'd been there for 100 years. She'd done everything. She's a teacher, principal, everything, right? Central office person. And she looks and sounds like one of the sisters from The Simpsons, like to the point where it's like you would expect her like light up chain smoking in a school office building. And I'm taking a meeting with her and she looks at me and she says like, you talk like the people at the Franklin Institute. We're supposedly doing a school with them. I don't know what's going on with it. Let me make a call. And she gets on the phone and she said, I've got this kid here. He talks like you. You have 5 minutes for him? And she gets off the phone and she says, I'm going to send you to the Franklin Institute. I can't keep the accent up. I'll lose my voice. She's like, I'm going to send you to the Franklin Institute. We're supposedly talking with them. I don't know what's going on with this project, but you're going to go talk to their senior vice president and go over there right now. And I had this packet I was shopping, which was the white paper, my resume, some clippings from some of the stuff we've done in New York. And I go up to the executive offices of the Franklin Institute, which is this famous science and technology museum in Philadelphia. The executive offices are really intimidating, right? It's the high walls. It's the chairs that have been there since Ben Franklin's time. That's actually not a joke. Pictures of dead white people everywhere, right? Like, it is a really intimidating place. And I go knock on this woman's door, Dr. Carol Parson. And this very elegant older woman comes to this door. And she looks at me and she says, you have 5 minutes. And I don't talk now as fast as I used to. Like, I was a pure New Yorker, right? Like, I could talk 1,000 miles an hour. And so I hand her the packet. And the first thing she says, she looks at, she says, "What is an English teacher doing wanting to start a science high school?" And I said, well, you know, I'm not just an English teacher. I teach technology and teach all this other stuff. But the Franklin Institute doesn't just want to start a science high school. And she says, "Excuse me?" I said, well, you start a science high school, you get great science and math teachers, but every other teacher will feel like a second-class citizen because you're not really focusing on their subject. If you make it a subject-oriented school, that's all you'll get. But if you make it an inquiry-driven high school where the ethos of the school has the same ethos of this museum, hands-on, ask big questions, do great things, go that way, that's how you'll get great English and history teachers. That's how you'll have a thematic approach to the way that everybody learns. And of course, you'll have an incredible science program. It's affiliated with the Franklin Institute. That's the high school you want to start. And she says, keep talking. And 5 minutes turned into 2.5 hours. And 2.5 hours has turned into 16, 17 years now. And one school has turned into three. But it was that moment. And I say to the kids all the time, because they're like, well, if I'm not somebody's first choice, and I'm like, who cares? Do you get to do the thing? Do the thing. Do you get to do the thing that you want to do? You get to do the thing that you think your life's going to be about? Do the thing. Doesn't matter if you're the first choice. Do the thing. And it's just like heart and hustle, right? Heart and hustle.
A great American myth is that people who succeed are the people who simply tried harder. But we are reminded by Chris and our other goodniks that even with all the heart and hustle in the world, we still need other people to show up, point the way, give us a chance, and add fuel to our fire. Jesse is an expert in building movements, organizing thousands or sometimes millions of people to make change.
It's so cliche that Margaret Mead quote, like, never doubt that an ordinary group of people can change the world. In fact, it's the only thing that ever has, or I'm paraphrasing, of course. But it's my whole life feels like it's been a lesson in that. From like running for student government in elementary school or wanting to change the policy around extracurricular activities in middle school, or worrying that we like didn't focus enough on racial justice at this like beautifully multiracial middle school that I went to. It just occurred to me that as an individual, you only had so much power. And because I wanted to make change when I was young and I had no institutionalized power, it seemed very logical to me. You'd have to get numbers. You'd have to like bring your peers into it. And if there were enough of you, if you were organized enough, if you were loud enough, it would be too difficult for them to ignore you. But I would say where this manifested in like such a powerful, concrete way for me is that, and it's a two-part story. So I am a freshman at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Go Badgers. It is the greatest playground for activists and movement builders in the entire world. I didn't know that. I didn't want to go there. My dad said, you'll love it. I said, I can't believe you're denying me the opportunity to go to a fancy East Coast school. He said, this place is going to change your life. He was totally right. UW-Madison is the greatest place on earth. But I arrive on campus and, of course, I want to run for student government. And I did get elected and I won by a really significant margin. And I'm like, this kind of works. You have conversations with a lot of people, things happen. And it worked so well that when I was 19 and there was an open seat on the city council, I got recruited to run for city council based on my organizing running for student government. And in fact, I got elected to the city council because grassroots power, baby. Like, nobody else had knocked on students' doors for 5 months for a city council seat. Now, I ended up getting sued and never sat in that city council seat because you know what? Young, progressive women are threatening as heck to the political establishment. But I digress. I guess like I have had this beautiful experience my whole life of grassroots power not being a theoretical idea. Like I just see it in action and I am a junkie for the process of grassroots power building. I love that personal connection. I love inviting people into that experience of being something bigger than themselves.
David founded a nonprofit that organizes against genocides around the world.
Often it's the survivors of atrocities who become the folks who build the museums, build the organizations, and they have to carry all of their trauma and still show up. And often when I would see my grandpa speak or other survivors, regardless of what atrocity, a young person would be like, how do you do this? Right? And often the answer is, how can I not, right? This is their way of honoring those they've lost. It's their way of healing and doing the work to, in their way, to make never again a reality. It becomes almost an obsession for some folks once they get into this work. And I've seen that electricity from that I saw at the very first Together Remember vigil, when I saw several Holocaust survivors, children and grandchildren of Armenian genocide survivors, and others from Rwanda and elsewhere come together and hug and embrace. And I saw in their eyes, no words had to be said. They were just crying. And just, you see the manifested healing and the power that we get from that. And I just am like, this is the currency of social awakening, of changing the world. I am in the business, I am in the organizing of instrumentalizing people's trauma to wake the world up, to make it a better place. And we have to be careful with that. So I took it, it crushed me that we were able to broadcast that sort of content, but there wasn't as many people watching. But I come back to that sort of, the streetcar boycotts and the Montgomery boycott, and hope that of those thousands of people who watched, maybe one of them's gonna say, you know what, maybe 5 years from now, maybe 20 years from now, it's going to be time to dust this idea off, and maybe it will work now. We'll learn from the mistakes and the successes of prior work. That's the whole ballgame, the community that you're building and centering those closest to the pain and building allyship that's not performative, but really real over the long term.
Tanara is a disruptor who battles inequity wherever she finds it.
One of my, dear friends at this point in my life is Tamar Manasseh, who runs Mothers Against Senseless Killings. And us finding community didn't come from I showed up one day and did some stuff. And I met her because we were trying to bring her into Fjord when I was leading the Fjord practice in the Midwest to actually have a conversation with our designers. And we were using the problems that she's trying to solve with MASC as a design constraint, a design exercise. And getting to know her and getting to know the people who work with her and understand what she's trying to do has been both really inspirational for me, because you want to talk about somebody who takes on fights, that woman, right, is phenomenal. But I also realized that we bonded over how lonely some of this is. Like, as a leader in design practice, trying to bring conversations about equity into a design space like Accenture, we had something in common because she was really fairly lonely trying to figure out how she was going to do all these things. You know, a nonprofit that went from zero to 60 overnight with some pretty sizable things to confront. And so you find folks that you can also just break down with and be vulnerable with and have these moments where you can say, I don't know how I'm going to keep doing this. And you hear people say things like, I got you. Or what do you need? How can I help? Right. And so you start to find yourself a little bit, and humanity a little bit, and empathy a little bit, and vulnerability a little bit. And that's how you build community. That's how I build community.
Michelle is the director of planning for a community institution in Miami.
Somebody who's unfortunately no longer with us was my first boss. Professionally, when I graduated college, I went to work at the Jewish Home for the Aging. And she was somebody who had this quiet strength and really was able to help me see myself as an agent of change. I thought of myself, as I said, I think before, a helper and somebody who wanted to serve and help people. But I think she helped me think about myself even more broadly, that I could impact social change. I think about her very, very frequently. And so it's something that stays with me, is how can I continue to inspire others? How can I give that confidence in people that I work with? And how can I ensure that I do so in a way that engenders, care and compassion and support for others? I think that you have to have humility to recognize that you don't necessarily have, all the answers or know that you're going to be successful. I think there's always trepidation in terms of thinking about, is this something I can do? Is this something I have the capacity to do? Especially when it's uncharted waters. It's easier when this has been done and let's follow this path. But if you're trying to come up with a new way of doing things, it's scary because you just don't know where to take the next step. You know, and I think that's where bringing in others is really helpful, you know, so that you recognize that this is not something you have to do on your own. You don't have to have all of the ideas of how to do it. But if you bring in people who have different perspectives, who have different life experiences, who can be resources, then it doesn't feel quite so daunting.
Jennifer is a neonatal ICU nurse where she spends her days caring for critically ill babies.
It's unlike anything else that I've ever experienced, the way that I connect with my people there. And when I say my people, I mean the ones who I have connected with. Not only is it a 12 and a half hour shift and you got to find something to talk about or you will lose your mind. So it gets very personal, but I can't think of any other place in my life that feels like a code blue where a patient is dying. I can't think of any place else in my life where I have to be on point. I need to not just be acting in the moment, but I need to be predicting what's next so that I can respond to that event as it happens. I can't think of any place else in my life that I have to think and act that quickly and then at the same time depend on the people around me to be doing that same thing. And so the intimacy that comes, I mean, I feel like we have to be able to read each other's minds. The intimacy that comes from going through an event where you either save a life or, God forbid, don't. That shared experience puts a person into a special place, a special connection. I think in some ways, I when you push yourself to that edge, it's often done for me and in isolation, but to be able to push that and have somebody do it right beside me at the same time, it's sort of like a lifeboat connection, you know, like the people that made it out. It's different. It's a different kind of connection.
We often hear about the importance of mentors. But we heard our Goodnicks hint today at an even more important role, champion. A champion collaborates, brings people in, partners with them on ideas, and helps them work through adversity. Behavioral economists describe it this way. Mentors show people where the opportunities are, while champions go an extra step further and open the doors to those opportunities. Who is championing you and your work? And are you the champion for anyone? In our next episode, we hear how our Goodnicks convert the worst moments in their lives into good work in the world. When faced with tragedy and trauma, how do they remain hopeful and even use their trauma as a catalyst of their work or to recommit to their work? Thank you for being part of Goodnicks. Goodnicks was created and executive produced by Jeff Leitner, produced by Amanda Roscoe Mayo, with original music by Adam Ohlendorf. I'm your host, Annalisa Enrile. Goodnicks is supported by the Jim Joseph Foundation and inspired by every one of you who is doing good in the world. To learn more about Goodnicks, visit goodnicks.org. That's GOODNIKS.ORG. Or follow us on Twitter at The Goodnicks and on Instagram at the_Goodnicks.